All right, welcome to the Clerks 2, what we're calling the technical commentary track.
Very technical.
We're going to sit around and get technical about the movie. And when we say technical, we don't mean like, what exactly is ass to mouth? Although we will define it right here and now. It's not rim jobbing. It's when you take your cock out of someone's ass and stick it in that same person's mouth.
Without washing,
without a stop for a mini dip or anything, directly ass to mouth. But that's not the kind of technical stuff we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about technical aspects of filmmaking, mechanics, particularly the cinematography, like this shot right here. And we'll turn to our good friend and cinematographer Dave Klein to tell us, how was this accomplished, sir?
Hi, this is Dave Klein, the cinematographer for Clerks 2. This was a composite shot. We shot it the reverse towards the store. We shot green screen. We shot color stock, green screen, this shot here.
Was the black and white? We shot some black and white.
We shot black and white. Everything up until we have color elements was black and white.
So up until the moment he opens that shutter.
That's right. And the stuff that we did on color stock, Joe actually put some black and white grain into it. He took the color out, put some black and white grain into it that we shot references for.
Joe Grossberg, who was the CG supervisor, and he did all the shots, including that one.
Now, I read online some cats were not convinced by the fire elements, but I mean, what are you going to do? It's fire, color fire on a black and white palette. So, of course, it's going to look weird. But those shots of the burned out store, those look, I think they're fucking seamless. Those are flawless. So much so that when I was out doing the press tour, people were like, wow, it's weird. Is that store still open? And I said, yeah. And they're like, oh, so how did they let you just burn it down like that? Apparently, press not very bright. They thought that we literally burned it down, but we used some green screen. We threw up green screen. Did you guys ever think you, Scott Mosier, producer Scott Mosier, and you, Dave Klein, DP, ever think we'd be doing green screen in a Clerks film? Did you ever think we'd even do another Clerks film?
No. But coming back to it, you know, I mean, I guess coming back, like, it actually shows you the progress, like, what's happened over the last 10 years, where it's like, you know, since we made the first one, it's like doing green screen shots, doing CG shots, even for little things, has become much more accessible. You know, we were like a $5 million movie, and we had at least 15 shots.
The Batman shot right there.
I like the Batman shot. I think also, we wouldn't have known how to do a green screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, back in the day, especially with black and white, it would have been virtually retarded.
Wouldn't have worked. That's your old house.
That is, but save that stuff for the cast commentary. Although I will point out that fence is no longer there. I drove past it a few weeks ago, and they replaced it with a faux white picket fence. So I preserved that little moment in time.
This is cutting back and forth from driving shots in L.A. to Jersey. I think it all cut together really well.
It did. Like right here, anytime we're in close, and this two shot here, they're in.
We're outside.
Where were we?
We were in Orange County.
And then for the wide stuff like the Batman shot you just saw, the shot of them pulling up outside of Randall's house, and some of the passing set, like this shot right here, that's in Jersey.
Yeah. I think there's one shot of Brian from a handheld shot from the interior of the car.
Right.
That was in the beginning when he was driving up. That was also, that was Jersey. But it did cut together kind of nicely. We got lucky because by the time
that
we got to Jersey.
That's Jersey.
By the time we got to Jersey, which was the tail end of the shoot, it was still kind of green. It is the Garden State. It was still kind of green, and even though it was like October, November, when was it?
Yeah. It was November.
Yeah, we got lucky. So sometimes you'll see in the background shots with, you know, some dead trees, but that's just, you know, neglect. And sometimes you'll see very lush things that kind of blended well with the stuff that we had. See, there's some fall colors in the background. That's another CG shot, correct?
Another CG shot, yeah.
What was CG'd in that shot? The sign is practical.
The sign is practical. Literally, the only CG part is like the smudges, all the burn, sort of like scorch marks.
Which would have been easy to do practical, but it would have been a pain in the ass because the toppers, see those scorch marks, the black marks? The cats that own the Quick Stop, that sign is CG, correct?
That was an empty sign that we kind of, once we got there, we were just like, it'd be easier just to do.
Once again, the genius of Joe Grossberg. But the toppers don't, they really don't, they'll let us come in and and shoot, but they never close the store down for us to shoot. And you can't hold up much traffic going in and out of it, so we figured it'd just be better to add those scorch marks. How much does something like adding a few scorch marks cost?
That kind of shot, I mean, based on the scanning and then the shot, I mean, maybe it's, you know, $800 to $1,000. It's not that much. Stuff like that, you know, like, I mean, this, you know, once you start doing 3D elements, when you're building 3D objects and stuff like that, that's where you start to really, things start to get more and more expensive. But that kind of stuff where it's like more of a lock off and he doesn't have to track the building, you know, the camera's not moving. Mm. It's those shots are not that expensive.
Now, all those tight cooking shots that we did, what they call inserts, I wasn't even on set for them. I was up in the editing room, editing, working. I think I was working on the dance sequence at that point. And you guys ran a line from the camera all the way up, a cable from the camera all the way up to the room where I was editing, which was right next to the movies. Boy, that's some camera trickery right there. Amazing camera trickery.
I'm not even going to explain how we did that.
No, don't let them wonder. Movie magic. And then you ran a cable up, and there was a little monitor right there, and I had a walkie-talkie.
Yeah.
And then I could just say, yeah, that frame looks good. The laziest directing, perhaps, I've ever done in my life.
Well, didn't Spielberg, from The Lost World, he did it from, he
from
was
New
in
Coast
New York.
Or something, right.
I thought they were in Hawaii, and he was in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
That movie made $300 million.
Yeah.
Ours, not so much.
You should have been farther away. Perhaps maybe the farther away.
The distance.
Yeah.
Well,
been in New Jersey.
Everyone says our movies would be a lot better if I were farther away from them. Let's talk about the very unique look of this flick, and who better to address that than Dave. The idea going into it was we had a discussion about it. It was one of the few films that we actually had a real discussion about the look of the flick, and I wanted grain, but initially, of course, I since we shot Clerks in 16mm, I figured shoot Clerks 2 in what would be the modern-day equivalent of 16mm, which would be something like digital video.
Yeah.
But, Dave, you didn't want to do that because?
I didn't think HD was the right choice for this movie, mainly because dealing with all the windows when we're inside.
Right.
It would have been really hard to balance.
For those that don't understand, like me,
well,
what does that mean?
HD and even you know, some of the other film stream cameras like the Genesis or the Viper, they still don't have the latitude that film has. So we would have been...
What kind of latitude? What do you mean latitude?
Meaning, you know, film, you have a certain amount of stops from dark to light that film can capture and you can deal with acceptably. Whereas HD is just a little smaller. That range is a little smaller. Mm-hmm. So when you're shooting from inside looking at a window, it's harder to deal... It's harder to balance. So you're going to end up gelling the windows all the time. And
if you don't gel the windows, what happens? They get blown out?
They get blown out, yeah.
Well, you have to if you're exposing for the inside, then the outside's going to be blown out. Whereas with film, you can expose it for the inside and still get something.
And even a few years ago, film wasn't where it is today. Mm-hmm. Like even, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, we would have ended up gelling the windows for film. But on this picture, we shot all 500 speed, which gave us a little bit of grain, and we just let the windows go. And I think they may be a little far in some scenes, but I think it turned out pretty well.
It did. So letting go of the doing HD or something like that, or digital video or whatever, we decided to move forward. We talked about doing 16 or Super 16. Dave wanted to shoot 35, so we went 35. And since you said we shot on the 500?
We shot everything except for the dance sequence on a Vision 500 stock, Kodak Vision 500 stock. It's a tungsten balanced stock that I didn't correct for daylight, which also... it desaturates the image just a little bit.
And then on top of that, I kept referring to 25th Hour, going, I like the look of 25th Hour. 25th Hour has this real grainy, lived-in feel to it. Did they shoot on the same stock or no?
They did. They did a DI like we did, but they also did some photochemical stuff. I think they pushed the entire movie or most of the movie to stop, and then they did a percentage of a bleach bypass, which we didn't do. But we did a DI, and knowing that we were going to do a DI, we shot 3 perf, which saves 25% of your film stock in processing. So that money could go towards the DI.
And the DI stands for?
Digital Intermediate.
And we arrived at that because I like the look on 25th Hour. We wanted to do it on this, so Dave said, Well, they did a DI, a digital intermediate. Now, explain what a digital intermediate is for those folks who don't know.
A digital intermediate is where you you basically scan every frame and turn it into a digital file. Mm-hmm. And we didn't exactly scan everything. We transferred from, we did the basically the low budget DI, where we went to HDSR, which is an uncompressed HD stock. Mm-hmm. It's a data stock. And then from there, we went onto drives where we do all our color correction. And from there, we go back out to film.
So there was never any...
We don't cut negative.
We don't cut negative. There was no work print like normally sometimes. Yeah. Like you, every flick, we've had work print sooner or later.
We've had work print. You watched it. I mean, like we didn't... You watch your... For most films, not nowadays, not really, but you would watch... You would do film prints, and that would be your dailies that you would watch on a daily basis. And then when you came time to test screen, you would conform that work print to do it. But nowadays... It's less and less. People are testing on video. People are doing HD transfers of all their dailies. They're watching high def dailies. Everything is kind of changing right now. Mm-hmm. But the DI, it started out with, I can't say for sure that Oh Brother Where Art Thou was the first digital intermediate, but it's very close to being right around time.
Yeah, I think it was actually, I think Pleasantville was the first one that did a full...
And that those movies actually cut negative, and then you scan the entire negative like a CG shot, and then you take that scan negative, all the reels put together, and then you time that. And for us, we
time it in a computer.
You time it in the computer,
kind so you of can like remove you color the, elements, put in
you
dial
can do
up.
Anything.
You could dial into like one little thing on somebody, like a button on somebody's coat.
For example, that shot of Ben Affleck that we just had, we put a window around him because the actual windows in the frame were a little too blown out.
Mm-hmm.
So we put what's called a power window around him and tracked him back and forth as he moved, just so we could treat him separately than the windows. So we kept
on
him
a hard drive.
Exactly.
Basically gives you all the it's like the your video transfer technology that was around for years has now become the technology that you can film your release. You can time your release prints in the same way. And
yeah, I think it's gone even a little further. We did all the color correction for this movie on what's called a luster. And I think the company's Discreet that makes it. Dave Cole was our colorist.
Dave
and
Cole.
He's done a lot of work. And he was
King
amazing.
Kong. Did he do King Kong?
He did, he did Kong. And I think either
Atlantis.
One... What's
yeah,
that?
Wasn't he working on Southland Tales?
Yeah,
he also did one of the rings.
Yeah, he was from Australia. But the way that we did it is, now they're doing, the way that we did it was we transfer this stock, and for a lot of movies they transfer, when they scan it, it's like a 2K scan, and nowadays they're doing 4K scan.
Explain that, 2K, 4K.
It's like a resolution.
It's the amount of information, whereas like an HD tape is basically 1800, so a scan is 2K, so it's slightly higher than HD resolution, or you can go to 4K, which is...
I guess, but what we did...
So that gives you what, crisper picture, more...
Exactly. Yeah. I think doing this, going back to this, I think if we were to do it again, I probably would have held out for a 4K scan, just because I think once we got into all the dupe prints and comp prints, I think it was a little soft.
The more prints we made? Because basically what happens is there is no negative until the end of the process.
Right.
The negative becomes the video transfer we do every day. Basically almost becomes the film's negative because we transfer from negative to this HD format and then those become the master tape. So it's kind of become the negative. And then when we're done cutting the film, and when you got done cutting the film in the Avid, then we take an EDL, which is an edit decision list. We take that to a online room and basically they just, from that, they build the movie out of those tapes, the transfers. And then basically that becomes the movie.
And then spit out a negative for it. A negative is created. What is it? An inter-negative, inter-positive? What's it called?
Well, at that point, it's just a negative.
It's just
flat
negative.
Out your first thing. Yeah.
And then from that, they strike.
And from that,
prints. How many prints
IPs.
Can you strike off the?
Well,
off
they'll make an IP or a couple IPs
they'll
off of it.
Make a couple IPs.
How many prints you get out of the IP? You think?
I don't know. I think a few hundred.
Yeah,
maybe.
I can't remember where the cutoff point is, but at
so
a certain
long
point,
and short, is it a? Cost-effective means for somebody who's not, like, this is not an expensive movie. It's about $5 million bucks. So is it a cost-effective means for somebody who wants to, like, I remember back in the day when we shot the first Clerks, neg cutting, when you actually went to your neg cutter and had them cut, was not a very cheap part of the process. I think it was about a grand, maybe $2,000, if I remember correctly. Is it a cheap way of shooting, if whether you're shooting on film or shooting on digital video or HD, is this a cheaper way to go about making your flick, you think?
To do this,
the poor man's digital intermediate?
Ultimately, you're still going to spend more money doing this than you would. If we'd have shot 35, cut
on
negative,
35.
And then regular processing and timing, it would have been cheaper.
Yeah, it would have been cheaper, but we wouldn't have been able to do what we did.
Right.
I mean, the overall desaturation and you know, the control over the contrast and all that is, you have much more control in a digital intermediate than an optical finish.
And the whole idea behind it was to give it the lived-in feel of I wanted something. I didn't want it to be bright and poppy like a studio comedy, like a Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back or even a Mallrats. We wanted it to have, like, a kind of aesthetic that would make it, you know, kind of stand beside Clerks and kind of work without
its own look.
Yeah, without it being glossy. And it was already like, already you're shooting with a budget, you got some names in the cast, you're shooting most of the movie in color. It was already going to be a world away from the first one, but we wanted it to be kind of close in the aesthetic and sensibility, so we went for a lived-in feel. I wanted it to have the lived-in feel of like a VHS copy that had been passed around a little bit, and that's ultimately what we got. But it sounds like we spent a lot of money to accomplish something that on the first one we accomplished by virtue of the fact that we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah. It's not, the difference is not obscene. Mm. You know, the amount of money difference is not obscene, but it's definitely still like on a pure numbers basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's more expensive to do this, to go through it. But it what it affords you is it gives you a pretty amazing piece of technology, and the things that you're able to do with it are like the window boxing. Like, you can, you know, there's scenes later on when we go to the pussy troll scene, and you know, he added this really hot white light kind of on the, you know, like he can really touch things up in a really specific way that you ultimately can't do elsewhere. And the resolution is just what we did is the HDSR route, and Dave and I watched a test before we did it, and the resolution of the HDSR is just below a 2K scan, so it's not the same. That's why it's the sort of independence version, because it's ultimately like not as expensive as it's not as crisp.
It's not quite as crisp. And it's a lot cheaper. It's a lot cheaper than scanning everything. And there are a number of ways you can get a look like this optically, but not on our budget, you know, because you're either going to have to deal with doing something to your prints, which, you know, we know that wasn't going to happen on a movie this size.
Right.
You can do things to your prints or to your negative, but ultimately it's a lot more expensive.
What I dig about it is it has a very specific look to it. And like, you know, I saw a few movies in theaters this summer, or last summer rather, and this movie kind of looked very different than most of those movies. And we kind of went for that look. We went to grab it. Like, we, you know, with Clerks, it was by virtue of the fact we had no money and very little experience. We chose to kind of go for this look and kind of accomplished it. Did you ever hear from anybody who was like, what happened? It looks bad. Like, I was always worried that there would be people who are like, it looks like shit, not understanding that the intention was for it to have a kind of lived-in feel.
Right. I never heard anybody, you know, badmouth me, but...
Nobody mistook it for a mistake.
Right. The thing that I love about it is that we just went for a real natural, kind of gritty, earthy look, and I think that's what we got. Like I was talking about earlier, I wish we would have done a 4K scan just because it just retains a little more information, you know, so it wouldn't really change the look, but I think ultimately you'd have a little bit, it's a slightly sharper image in the theaters, and I think it would have just retained a little more of what we did.
But also at the end of the day, it's like the theatrical life is so short,
the
video life is forever, or DVD life, or whatever the next format is. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, would it have made a difference on video or no, between a 2K and a 4K?
On video, nobody has the monitors. I mean, I can't say for sure, but I guess if you got into that world, I don't think anyone has the capacity to play things back on a level that you would ever notice a difference.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would.
You can't tell.
Another thing we did with this movie that, looking back, we could have done a little differently is when you do a digital intermediate, you have a choice to shoot like regular 1.85, or we could have shot super 35, you know, super 1.85, mm-hmm. not changing the aspect ratio, which also may have made it a little bit sharper. Mm-hmm. But I decided to go with the regular 1.85 just to retain the grain.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying before we shot 3 perf. Why was that?
It's, well, when you're doing a DI, you don't have to worry about an optical
leaving
step.
The sound. An optical, for those who don't know what it is, when you have a...
No, I mean an optical step to get from, like, 3 perf. Basically, when you shoot 4 perf, which is the norm, mm-hmm. you have a lot of wasted space on the top and bottom of your frame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So with 3 perf, you're just sandwiching. You're putting the frames closer together.
Like
so there's less waste.
I gotcha.
If you consider the screen, uh-huh. like, this is a simplified way to explain it, but those black bars would be on your regular 35. Like, that space would be there. And by shooting 3 perf, it's like... We eliminate that, and we scrunch the frames together.
So the frames are right on top of one another.
Just about.
There's a tiny space.
There's still some room.
So it has nothing to do with the optical track, yeah. like sound.
No, but in order to go from a 3 perf to prints, mm-hmm. you would have to do an optical step like you do with Super 35,
mm-hmm.
unless you're doing a DI.
Yeah, right. You would have to create another negative from it. But since we knew we were going to do the DI, it didn't matter because we were... Gonna have to create another negative anyways.
Right, and the DI, it doesn't matter. You shoot 4 perf, 3 perf, you shoot 2.35, 1.85, it all spits out the same when you go back to film.
And we also did it because we weren't budgeted to do a DI, and it was something that we kind of came up with during prep. We were already on the way, so while we were prepping, we were figuring out how to collapse costs on top of each other and, like, mm-hmm. get the money to do it. And so, you know, that was like a $30,000 savings or yeah. something like that that we were able to take from just stock and a little bit of transfer time. And then you basically were able to put that towards the DI.
Now, there are two moments in the movie where we go for a very different aesthetic than in the rest of the film. One, as you kind of mentioned before, is the dance sequence. When we were in pre-production on the movie talking about the look of the film, going for this DI look, going for the lived-in feel, we decided that the one area where we would not kind of make it be grainy or look lived-in and go for, you know, kind of slick, bright colors was on the dance sequence. And for that, did you shoot regular stock or?
I shot a slower stock, a 200 speed stock, also tungsten balanced, and I also corrected it for daylight, mm-hmm. which just means you retain all the colors that are there.
And then when you were in the room where you were doing the color timing or
yeah,
whatever,
we cranked it up a little bit. We cranked up the chroma a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that you'll notice the stock difference so much on the DVD, but in the theaters, I thought it was very apparent.
Totally, and I've seen it a lot on video as well, you know, while I was cutting it and when I was sitting there watching the flick over and over again and whatnot through various stages. And you do, the big noticeable difference is when Dante drops Rosario, the very next shot is him coming back into movies. And you right. see the world of difference between what yep. he looks like on the roof and what he looks like coming in and just how kind of dark it is. And
right.
it's you can kind of see it. Because the first shot where we actually go to the full color, I think, is Jay and Bob, isn't it?
It is. With the,
when
they start doing the head things.
Yeah,
the head thing from side to side. The whole dance sequence is in bright color. The other scene in the movie, which also came out of the 25th hour discussion, was we were watching that movie and looking at the various shots and various scenes, and I'm going, this is nice. We came to a club scene in that flick where it was kind of, they were kind of bathed in this bluish purplish light or whatnot.
Yeah, I remember you said to me, when we were watching it, you were like, that's the donkey show. I want the donkey show to look like that.
Well, first I was like, I just like the idea of it being all kind of one color,
yeah.
kind of like monochromatic. And I was saying, well, maybe we should do it in red. And then Dave said, it'd be awesome to do it in this color. And then we had this discussion, me, Dave, and Scott, about, like, do we go for a scene that's 10 minutes long, bathed in this bluish-purple light? And we kind of decided to go for it. And it is, like, a really striking sequence because of that.
I think it's pretty great. And initially, I don't know if I didn't agree with it or was just a little frightened by it. I just thought, how in the fuck am I going to do that? And then we just did some research and shot some tests during production, and just went for they're basically blue screen tubes that you use. They're KinoFlow tubes that you use when you're lighting a blue screen, and it just makes it a lot easier. And we put them in regular KinoFlow housings and used a lot of them, and I think it turned out really cool.
It did, and you'll see that way later in the flick. But and let it never be said that thought wasn't put into the look of this flick. And it was that we had to, because when you think about the first Clerks, one of the unspoken stars of that movie, or the thing that helped that movie along, the thing that people remember about it a lot or cite it in all reviews and whatnot, was its aesthetic, was its grainy black and white look. So when we were talking about doing a Clerks 2, you know, there was this long discussion between the three of us, because the three of us represented almost the entire Clerks crew on the first one. We were the only three on that movie, carrying over to this movie as well. Behind the scenes, because basically we were the only people really behind the scenes, with the exception of Ed every once in a while and Vinny from now and then. So we talked about, like, do we intentionally make it look like shit so it, you know, it kind of matches, but then wouldn't that be disingenuous because the only reason it looked like that the first time around is because we didn't have any cash and we were rank amateurs. If we try to, like, make it look like shit, isn't that trying to capture lightning in a bottle? We were already kind of moving away from black and white throughout most of the movie based on how it opens and how it ends. So we decided to kind of go the completely opposite direction. And rather than try to dumb down everything we know how to do now, 12 years or 13 years after making the first one, to actually kind of bring to bear everything we have learned since and make the film look as good as we could. So if you look at the flick, there's more movement in this movie than I think there was in anything that we've done together, in either Clerks, Mallrats, or Chasing Amy. A lot less of the stationary camera. I mean, sometimes it's stationary. Sometimes you don't always need to be moving, I feel, especially for the stuff that I do. But even on chatty scenes and whatnot, there's way more movement than we were kind of used to doing it. And that wasn't even something that we necessarily sat down and said, let's do this. That, like, sometimes there was something, because we would shot list in advance.
Right.
And me and Dave sat down over the course of 3 days, and Moj was there as well, and we shot listed with Tony, the AD. And then when we were on the set, things just actually kind of came about as well.
Right, right. It just kind of fell into place. I think it was just the experience of 13 years or however long it's been that just kind of helped us along, and it was pretty fluid, pretty easy. A lot of handheld dolly work, which is my personal favorite in the movie, I think, where our operator, Andy Graham,
one of the unsung heroes of the movie, too.
Absolutely.
Dude who's he's the operator, and he was a focus puller, right, on Mallrats?
Yeah, we met on Mallrats. Yeah, right. He pulled focus on Mallrats, and since then he's been operating for quite a while. But he did a lot of work just handheld off the dolly, which turned out really nicely.
So Dave, you shot Clerks and Mallrats and Chasing Amy, and then took a powder for Dogma, Jane Silent Bob Strike Back, and Jersey Girl, not by your own choice. I mean,
let's talk about it now.
Every time we'd make a movie after Chasing Amy, it started on Dogma first. Me and Moj went to Sundance. What was it? It was Sundance for Chasing Amy. We were all there.
Yeah,
it was, and Dave was there too, and I was going out with Joey Adams at the time. She was there, and we went up to this meeting with Harvey Weinstein. And it was before Chasing Amy had its initial screening at the festival.
It was the evening of.
Yeah,
it was great.
Oh, this is where it gets even better. So we go up and we have this meeting at the Stein Erickson Lodge with Harvey, and Harvey's just like, "Look, I know you guys want to do Dogma next, but you know it's a weird, difficult movie, and you guys want to make it." For at that point, I think they were talking about $3 or $4 million. And he's like, "Well, I can give you the budget, but you can't cast Joey in the lead because I want her to play Bethany. And you can't, and Dave Klein can't shoot it. You got to get an experienced shooter." So it was a weird roll down the hill for me and Moj because, you know, I was like, "Look, I'll tell Joey if you tell Dave." And I was like, "No, you tell Joey, I'll tell Dave." You know, I was trying to figure out who was going to drop the bomb on who and whatnot. So we figured with Dogma, it would be like kind of a one-off. Like, we'll go shoot it with somebody else, and then next movie around, we'll be able to come back to Dave. Next movie, same thing happened. Like, Bobby Oman shot Dogma, did a nice job and whatnot. Then we go to Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and the same thing. No, you got to get somebody who knows how to shoot big studio comedy.
It's bizarre to me that they wouldn't let you use Yeoman.
Yeah, I don't know what the case with Yeoman not on Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was. He might have been busy, or
oh, is that what it is?
He might have been, but it was more about the question about you too, where we were like, let's use Dave, and they were like, no, you got to use somebody who knows how to shoot comedy.
It was also literally just like it went like, can't use Dave, and they were like, all right, well then let's use Bob, and they were like, no.
They wouldn't let us use Bob either on that movie.
No, and they basically were like, we need somebody who's done more green screen.
And so Jamie Anderson came into it.
Jamie
Once
Anderson,
again, nice job. Good guy.
Who had done like the Flintstones too, or he'd done Small Soldiers. And then when we went to go do Jersey Girl, basically they were like, can we use Dave? And they were like, no. And then we said, can we use Jamie Anderson?
Yeah, and they said no.
And we're like, why? And they're like, because you need somebody who hasn't shot any green screen.
their thing was like, where you're shooting a big movie, this is your most commercial flick to date. You need somebody who knows how to shoot big commercial movies, shoot movie stars and crap like that. And so we get Vilmos Sigmund, which, you know, on paper is like, wow, there are worse things that can happen than work with like an Academy Award winning DP. Not a great fit at all. Just, you know, that's all there is to say about it. I mean, he shoots a good looking movie, but not a great fit.
So based on your theory, there's someone out there better for me than ever.
So when we come to Clerks 2, we again had the discussion of like, all right, so Dave's going to shoot this. And initially there was just like, and they hedged and we said, no way, there's no way. You got me and Moj back. You got Brian and Jeff back. You got me and Jay playing those roles back. You can't not include the guy that shot the first one. We can't not do that. So that made it kind of easier to make the argument. Plus, we were at a lower budget scale. So that's what we were doing for those years. What were you doing during that missing period?
Struggling.
Just sitting in a room with a shotgun in one hand and a phone in the other.
A picture of Mosier and Smith on the wall. And the people to kill list. a lot of indie features, maybe, you know, probably 10 independent features, some of which you can find on DVD these days, some of which you can't.
Mm.
And I did some TV. I did two seasons of a TV show called State of Grace.
Mm.
And recently, a TV show in Hawaii called Flight 29 Down, which both of those are kids' shows.
Mm-hmm.
That's been at various movies and TV stuff.
And during that time, did you feel you learned? I mean, you must have learned. I feel like I learned in the
absolutely.
Years off.
Absolutely. You know, the greatest thing for me was doing episodic TV.
Why?
Just because it's day in and day out, and you're just always working. And, you know, there's an immediate...
it's an easier learning process because you're learning.
Absolutely, because you're learning things every day, and I think that's what helped out the most.
Right.
I did one season of State of Grace, and then went away and did a low budget picture called Tattoo, a love story, and then came back and did a second season. I think it was on that second season that really did wonders for me.
Right.
Yeah.
So for me, when we got done with shooting the flick, even while we were shooting it, like day one, day two. It was just, even before shooting, while we were in pre-production and talking about the movie and blah, 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 it was just always easier for me to relate to Dave because Dave and Scott and I all came up together. We all met each other in film school, the Vancouver Film School. I dropped out. These two cats stayed. We shot the first three flicks together. Aside from a shorthand, there's just the comfort of, like, we all started as neophytes and kind of learn together and whatnot. And then you go off and you make movies with other experienced or, you know, DPs have been working for a lot of years. You know, for me, there was always and not to bag on those dudes, they're all, well, two of them are really great guys. But you just, there's... But there's just, like, it's tough to suggest things or ask questions to people who are far older than you. It's already a weird... dynamic because you're younger than them and you're supposedly in charge and whatnot, but it was just always, I don't know, it's much easier to talk to Dave in terms of communicating what I want to do. And Dave, you know, even if it was a dumbass idea, Dave would be like, we'll give it a shot, but it might not work. But like, he would attempt it. Sometimes you got to get shot down real quick by the other dudes and whatnot. But the key, I think, was just the... It was weird. It was like after three movies of the team being broken up, there's no secret or no surprise to me that, like, you look at a lot of the reviews, and a lot of the reviews were like, it's their best movie since Chasing Amy. You know, like, there's just... I don't know. There's something there to it.
It was really comfortable too. I didn't,
very,
you know,
comfortable.
I didn't know what you were going to be like after you know three of the bigger movies, and it was just really easy. And it was,
I was the kind of director that you were afraid I would go off like at lunchtime, bring home young boys.
That's
to the
what
set,
I thought, really.
With my hand down her pants between like off camera
this is
and
my
whatnot.
Nephew.
Yeah.
And these are his nuts.
Yeah, but it was really comfy.
Yeah.
And we worked at a pretty good pace. Like, we were not slow by any stretch of the imagination. We were kind of expedient, getting good stuff every day. Did we ever not make our days?
I think that we, you know, I mean, it's a totally different experience. We shot, obviously, as you watch, 85% of the movie in one location. So it changes the way that you sort of reflect on schedule. So if you don't make your day, it's not the same as not making your day in a location you're only in for one day.
Right.
You go to a location for one day, you have to finish because you have to wrap out. And that's when you do 18-hour, 19-hour days. The last night we were here was a very, very long day because you're just like, this is it. We got to get everything. So, like, there are days where we didn't necessarily hit our projected mark.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily matter because you have the ability to make it up. It's more about, like, when we leave this location in 24 days, we have to have all the material. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you're not, you know, you want to make sure you're getting along. But I think there are a couple days where we didn't exactly hit exactly what we wanted, but it doesn't necessarily matter.
There were also days where we got what we wanted and then went back and redid it, like the opening Jay and Silent Bob scene. You know, as you can see in the deleted sequence, we shot a whole opening scene that I put together. And when I was watching it over the course of a week, 2 weeks, I was just like, I don't like it. It's just trying too hard. So let's reshoot something else. So since we're on the same location all the time, like one morning while we were waiting for somebody, or we were set up on that same wall, we were going to do the dance sequence day, it might have been. For the Jay and Silent Bob portions of the dance sequence with the boombox and whatnot, we said let's just go re-grab this new version of the opening scene.
Day. I think we did roughly like a half a day of you know reshoots, pickups, stuff like that
while still in production that we were able to squeeze into our day.
We ultimately added a day.
Mm-hmm.
We added one day to. Because we had to move to a Saturday to get Jason Lee.
Mm.
And then we also added a day, effectively. Well, I guess we almost did a day's worth of stuff. We added another day just to be like, look, it's way cheaper to add a day now than it is
to wrap and then come back. Not
and,
to
like,
mention the fact
stuff.
That once we left, like a month or two later, they bulldozed the entire location.
Yeah. And we had to fight the weather more than I've ever had to fight weather in L.A.
It's kind of strange, isn't it?
It was strange. Like, this scene right here, even, towards Rosario, was totally sunny, and towards these two, towards Jennifer and Brian, it was totally overcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the scene with Brian and Jennifer on the swings
was a nightmare. Scene 16, which took us the whole movie to complete.
Shot.
Like,
and
we
it
shot
mainly,
it so piecemeal.
It was mainly because of the weather.
Yeah, it was and, cloud cover and whatnot.
Yeah, it would roll in and roll out. And you'll see me fighting the windows a little bit, like the scene where Jeff and Trevor were just at the internet was totally overcast.
Yeah, yeah.
It was totally overcast outside, and other scenes it's really sunny. So we're constantly trying to balance everything the same and make it look like it was the same day.
Do you think anybody notices besides you?
Film school students.
You think so?
Yeah.
I've lived with this footage for a long, long time. Like, while we were shooting, I was cutting, and all the way up to cutting, you know, online trailers or whatever, and then putting the DVD stuff together, the cut scenes and bloopers and whatnot. It never occurs to me, like, wow, this wasn't, it's bright there, but it's dark here. But I'm a real visual idiot. Yeah, there's that. This scene kind of came about. Where the look of the scene dictated the performance of the scene, actually.
Uh-huh.
Like, I was sitting behind the monitor, and we were kind of framed up, I guess it was first on Trevor. And there was this kind of, since we were shooting on this prep table that was like stainless steel or something like that, and we had a light that was hitting it and bouncing back light, I kept looking at that shot in the monitor going, man, that looks like, it reminds me of like the shot in The Shining with Lloyd, your ghostly bartender, when Jack Nicholson goes into the bar and first there is no bartender, then there is, and he's talking about hair of the dog that bit me, Lloyd, like that kind of shit. I was like, man, that reminds me of The Shining. So I asked Dave, I said, dude, like, dial that up. Let's do even more. Like, let's hit it with a lot of light. And based on that, I had Trevor change his entire fucking performance, the delivery of the pillow pants thing. And it really, like, then later on when I was cutting it, we have that Shining type music come in. It was, that all came from, like, that light just hitting that fucking table.
And we didn't really change it much after you asked me to change it, and I just...
Well, thanks for fucking humoring me and saying, we did.
No, because we talked about it, and we decided that we could do it in the DI, which I think turned out pretty well. The only other thing we could have done is maybe a net behind the lens, which would have let it just bloom even more, but it kind of changes the feel of the picture entirely, so... I like the way it blows out. We just put a power window and brought up just the highlights in the bottom of the frame in the DI process.
Do you do that little back window, or was that left alone?
That was left alone.
Who's easiest to shoot? Like, in terms of people's complexion and...
Rosario.
Yeah?
Yeah, she cannot photograph poorly.
Really?
You have to put her in your next movie, every movie, man. So yeah, she photographs really, really well.
In what way?
She takes light really well. You know, wherever we had the key light, wherever it worked for her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's not really a way you can't light her. You know, with a lot of actors and actresses, you'll find that they don't like a light in a certain place, you know. But with
wasn't
her...
Wasn't the case that basically your skin pigment is based on light reflecting off of your skin?
True, but it's also the shape. You know, it's how the eyes are set and the cheekbones and everything. And she does have just beautifully colored skin, which reflects light really nicely. But also the shape of her face will just take light from any direction.
So when you're setting up for somebody like that, do you tend to use more light, less light?
You know, I like to overexpose actresses because it tends to make them look a little better, but... With this movie and with her, we really didn't have to. I think every face in this movie when we're inside is underexposed a little bit. This is probably one of my favorite looking scenes.
Why?
Because
that mustache?
The time,
you can't
because the mustache.
Shoot a mustache wrong?
Because it reminds me of Magnum P.I.
He does, especially with that collar.
I think it's the time of day that we shot this and the amount of sunlight we had outside is just perfect.
Mm.
And so it was really easy to shoot everything. And just the amount of ambient light that's coming in works really well with what we had going on.
Moj, was it a tough schedule to pull together? And do you remember how long it was?
It was just under 30 days, wasn't it?
It was 5 weeks here and then
it was
a week
5
in Jersey,
weeks,
right?
Which is with 1 6-day week. So it was like 4, 24, 30. So it was just over 30. It was like 33 days, 34 days. Not really.
With the first Clerks being 21 days.
21 days.
Straight.
Straight, but also they were shorter days, too.
Yeah,
they
were much shorter days. That much.
That's true. I guess if we had worked like average days, it wouldn't even been 21.
Maybe
18, you know what, though? It's like you always, you know, depending on what you schedule, it's like that's what movies live into, you know?
Pretty much, right. We just didn't have like... Like, you normally get to a set, you do a blocking, and then there's, like, an hour or 2 hours for people to set up a shot, the actors to go through makeup, wardrobe, and shit like that. On that movie, we didn't have that. It was just like, all right, set the camera up, let's go.
Yeah, set the camera. We had, I think, 2 lights, maybe 3 lights. Yeah. So you guys would walk to the front door, and we'd be ready. Turn around.
What,
The schedule wasn't that hard. I mean, you know, we didn't really have, like, in the past, there's, like, actor considerations, you know, there's a few scheduling. Jason, we had to make a schedule consideration
because he was working on Earl.
Because he was working on Earl, and he was good enough to, like, you know, wrap at 4 in the morning and then on Friday or Saturday morning and then come Saturday morning to us around, you know, 11:30 or noon. Rosario had a very small conflict with a couple of things, but, you know, I mean, usually, you know, we sit down and try to, you know, the first day was all the office stuff. Like, you know, usually you're trying to pick. So, like, let's do something. We get a lot of pages under our belt on the first day and something where, like, you know, like a good scene, a good dialogue scene or something like that. And then, so by the time we get to the end, when we hit the donkey show, which is where how we close out the location, everyone knows each other, the crew knows each other, and you're going to this scene that's like, you know, lots of coverage, lots of shit going on, and you hope that the weeks leading up to that sort of help everybody get accustomed to each other, and then, you know, you're going to be able to do more work and not be like, I mean, to do the donkey scene right away would just be frightening.
Yeah, we put that at the very, very end of the schedule. I mean, for other practical reasons, too, because we were forewarned that the donkey will shit and piss everywhere. And they were like, once it's done doing that, you're going to live with that smell for a while. So we figured, let it be the last thing we shoot in this movies. And this movies we found in Buena Park was this old Burger King that was off the main drag. And right across the way, whenever somebody walks outside, there's like a mechanics joint, like a tire joint. If you can kind of see through the tire joint, on the other side is the main highway, and that's where, like, Knott's Berry Farm is and all that shit. So this place was kind of off the beaten path, and they'd built this much newer Burger King on the main drag. So we found this location, got real lucky. It was housed next to this Days Inn motel, and we wound up using the Days Inn, a bunch of rooms on this top floor for production offices, for dressing rooms and shit like that. But once it was, once we found the joint, Ratface, our production designer, Robert Holtzman, Ratface, he calls himself. I always love that shot right there where we kind of go.
It's a nice shot.
Yeah, it's a real, bring it into focus, was sweet. That's another shot too, nice low Batman shot.
I like these shots. We actually mounted a...
What did you do? You mounted,
a very small, an Aeroflex 235 right on the go-karts. I think it turned out really well. There's another shot. This one here was where we had...
like an ATV or something?
No, it was one of these go-karts. It was just a two-seater, and we put a rig on the back, and Johnny Martin, our dolly grip, actually drove.
This was the go-kart track. Where was it?
Somewhere
in LA, half hour outside of LA, 45 minutes outside of LA, and we got to go in and call it skid marks and stuff. Once again, bring it back to Robert Ratface Holtzman, our production designer, who par excellence is the dude who came into that Burger King and turned it into a movies, and you know, really made it look so good that people would kind of drive up to the drive-through window. And kind of come in and try to buy stuff. There's a second use of the Batman shot right there. You like the car coming to or going away?
I like them both, but coming to, I like a little better because I think you can see the leaves falling off the bridge a little better.
Mm-hmm. That bridge is in Atlantic Highlands. It's like 2-3 blocks away from where Jeff Anderson grew up. But it's nice. It's back in Jersey, and it was the leaves that were kind of turning in that area. Yeah. And so we gathered up a bunch of leaves. I remember when we scouted it out, We saw some leaves on the side of the road. We were like, let's get as many together as we can. We could drop them off the bridge and throw them in the path of the car. It's pretty sweet. And I remember it was raining, too. It just started raining when we were getting that shot. So there's like two takes of it where it's like you could see the rain, but in those two takes, you can't. So Robert Holtzman, big ups to Ratface, who created the world of movies, as well as Scott Purcell, who the guy who designed movie from back as Dogma. He was the dude that I sat down with and was like, it's a cow in short pants. And then it was cartoony at first, and then we were just like, just bring it as close to Mickey Mouse as you can without getting sued, and that's how the look of movies came to be.
And now that you've said that,
yeah, we're screwed. Those two dudes had a shitload of fun filling every square inch of movies with like little visual jokes and nomenclature jokes,
signage
and whatnot. If you look at all the names of the products and whatnot, if you got a DVD, it must be on DVD because nobody's got VHS anymore. Just pause it and check it out, some of the stuff. King of the Juice was one of Ratface's favorites.
We had to build everything. We built all the playset. I mean, basically, we
barely built the playset. Yeah. The idea was it had to be the saddest little fucking gym, little jungle gym in front of a fast food joint, like as if, you know, 20 years ago, they were like, hey, McDonald's is building little playgrounds, we should compete.
Yeah.
And they threw up like these three things and then let it go and never put a fence around it. Like the slide goes right into a parking spot if you come off the slide. But
we gutted, we basically came into a, basically it got gutted, mm-hmm. you know, and.
Oh, we walked in there, it smelled like urine first.
There was a lot of homeless, people that, you know, who, if they're listening, we're sorry, but you guys peed all over the place.
Yeah. But thanks for buying the DVD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking your spare change.
Like, hey, I used to sleep there.
Yeah. That's awesome. But, I mean, those guys had to create the bags, the fry holders. I mean, we had to create
the window shades. I mean, everything. It's not like walking into a McDonald's and everything's done. I mean, the other nice thing about it, too, is not only did they create it, and if you look around at the restaurant, it's aged. It doesn't look brand new. Like, it's amazing watching them put the place together, because at first you're like, wow, it's crisp and it looks like it's just built. And then they go through this aging process where they take everything down and build grime into it and weather. Yeah, yeah, they pee on it. They get those homeless to come back and whiz all over it.
The exterior, too, I remember when it was first painted, it was really bright. And then Ratface did a whitewash or something on it. Just really toned everything down, made it look faded. And I think we helped that out also in the DI, where we took just the purples and the yellows. Like, you can really see it in the uniforms. And we just kind of dialed down the purples and the yellows, which made everything feel a little more faded.
Mm-hmm.
Washed out.
Yeah, it's weird. When you look at the uniform right here, it's almost, it doesn't look as purple as it does.
It's got a little bluish. Gray in it.
Yeah,
it's
or gray, gray, maybe. That's a, yeah.
But
there,
see,
when a light hits it, like when he had a little sunlight on him, you could see it's kind of, you could see the purple highlights.
But you'll also really see it when we get into the dance sequence. That's when the shirts are pretty accurate.
Right.
Which is coming up in a few minutes.
These cats, I remember the day we were shooting it, were really nice about, we were shooting in the other direction for most of the day because the light wasn't right coming through the windows. So we kept shooting toward the kitchen the whole time, and Earthquake and Wanda had to like wait around for, they don't think, I don't think we got them on film until like after lunch that day.
Yeah.
But man, did they bring the funny in a big bad way. Which do you think you had more fun shooting, the first one or this one?
Definitely this one.
Why?
I don't know what the fuck I was doing in the first one.
Yeah, but isn't ignorance bliss to some degree?
It's better to not shoot with fear.
Yeah.
What were you afraid of on the first one?
I don't know that I was afraid. I just didn't know what I was doing. And
did it frustrate you?
It was a little frustrating, yeah.
To not know what you're doing?
Yeah, and to be
the... How the fuck did you sell me on being the DP then? You're like,
I think Mosier sold
me. Is that what it is? Yeah. Like, let's grip this guy.
And you're like, I don't know. But also, just having to do absolutely everything.
Right.
You know.
It's nice having some crew, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Give a shout-out to two of your key crew members on this flick.
Well, Andy Graham, who we've talked about, was the camera operator. Jeremy Graham was the gaffer.
No relation.
No relation whatsoever.
Oddly enough.
But they, they're good friends now.
Mm-hmm.
The gaffer, Jeremy Graham, the gaffer, who's basically in charge of the electric department, and Otto Betancourt was a key grip.
I worked with Otto after this. I ran into him on the menu shoots for An Evening with Kevin Smith 2, Evening Harder.
He mentioned that, yeah.
It was wild.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, small world. Who else? Paul was your
Paul
focus
Malathic
puller?
Paul Malathic was the focus puller for the L.A. portion. Had Aaron Bowen as the second AC, and Q was our loader.
Q was the loader, that's right.
That's right.
And
crew.
Really good crew. So much so that it was sad, like, when we actually had to go back to Jersey for a week, that some of them didn't come with us and whatnot.
And Johnny Martin, I gotta say, our dolly grip.
Oh, fucking phenomenal. Yeah. Boy, that dude was good. And it's like, people go, oh, fucking dolly grip, how hard is it? It's fucking hard, man.
It is hard, and it's basically just an extension of the camera operator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a shame that the dolly grip's not in the camera department, because it's an integral part of the camera department. And he was a good one.
So on the first one, you're doing shit like loading a film yourself.
That's right.
On this one,
you know, it's amazing to me that as much of the first movie's in focus,
really,
as it is, because we didn't have a focus puller, you know.
No.
I think Vinny filled in a few times
when we ever had the rack
a little
bit,
yeah. And it was, you know, that's a hard job.
Oh yeah,
and just not to have somebody there is I don't know how we did it.
We were on the cutting edge.
Totally.
Of stupidity,
of stupidity, and a complete lack of experience and funds.
But, you know, just having a big crew and you know, having an operator is what makes the most difference for me. Because
now, in Mallrats, you were DP and operator, right?
No.
They wouldn't let you operate? Did you want to operate?
I don't think I did, you know, just because...
He operated on Chasing Amy.
Right. That's it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. just because it makes my job so much easier when you can just turn that part of it over to an operator, you know, because they set up the shot while I'm dealing with the lighting of everything. It makes it a lot easier and a lot more time efficient, actually.
Did we do multi-cameras on this movie very often?
A couple times.
Like during the dance sequence, we had a lot of cameras.
We had three cameras. Yeah, three cameras for the dance sequence, two cameras for the go-karts. Mm-hmm.
We had three cameras at one point on the camera.
On the go-kart.
On the go-karts.
On the go-karts.
Because we had that one little, like, Bolex kind of thing.
For a couple shots, we had three going.
Yeah.
And then we had two cameras for the donkey show, which we didn't use the entire time, but we did a lot of two-camera stuff at the donkey
show. This shot that we just had, like, pushing into Rosera, that was a crane shot, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had a little jib arm in there, a little jib arm and remote head. We were going to use that a lot more, but it just... We didn't have many walls that we could move in that place.
No,
I mean, Ratface made as many flyable walls as possible, but we couldn't move much. So that jib got really big in there really fast.
Mm-hmm. And then we used the techno crane on, or was it techno crane or super techno crane?
Super techno crane.
Sorry.
On the dance sequence.
We used it on the dance sequence. Did we also use it on the swing set sequence?
No,
or that was just a techno crane?
It was a Chapman crane, a Lenny arm we had on the swing sets. But we used the super techno at the golf cart, at the go kart
as well.
Yeah. For the final shot.
Were you scared about having to shoot a dance sequence?
I don't know about scared. I was.
What was the most nerve-wracking of the flick? What was the one where you're like, fuck? Like, for me, the scene that I was least looking forward to doing, even though I really love the scene, I love the donkey show scene. But I remember all through the movie, I was like, oh, man, I don't want to get to the donkey show, just because there's so many setups, so many logistics to pull off, and it's a very long scene in which many things are happening, and you're cutting in your head, and I was like, that was the one I was least looking forward to.
Yeah, I think I'd have to choose the same scene.
But for different reasons.
I was a little apprehensive about the lighting of it,
mm-hmm.
and it was a big setup, you know, especially the changeover from the normal movies lighting to the donkey show lighting.
Which we hid in the most ingenious or least subtle of ways with Randall snapping, and all of a sudden
and
the lighting
changed. It's such an enormous change that...
Because he makes it's Zach's character, the donkey fucker. Yeah, he's like, I set up a couple of lights. And then, like, the lighting setup that's kind of shown in the movie, it would have taken, what, day, 2 days to set up?
I think it took us a couple of days with, you know, five electricians and five grips.
And with the snap of a finger, everything goes purple. So here we're still kind of in the same mode we shot the rest of the flick, but it's when we get... to Jane, Silent Bob, when they start doing their head snap from side to side, I think that's the very first shot that we kind of go into full color. That shot always, to me, always looked fake.
This one?
Yeah, and the look, not this one.
Yeah, the one sky's down.
The one down, but that was shot in the location.
It is, but it's the reason it looks fake is because the sun had gone down.
Mm-hmm.
And we recreated everything in that shot. It is a
that
little
shot
fake.
Right there. Literally, you could have like created that shot with a fake piece of asphalt, threw some cigarettes on it, and a tiny piece. But I was there, and we did shoot it right on the location. This shit also looks fake, but this was really up on the roof.
Like there's the days in.
There's the days in right next door. He didn't bring in any extra roof shit, did he? That was all the shit that was just there.
That was just the stuff that was there.
He took a lot of stuff away.
Yeah, there was more stuff there. We had the steam, the
steam
coming
effect.
Out. Cost a lot of money.
Yeah, it was loot right there.
Technically,
I like the little touches too. Like I believe he had to move the movie sign up a little bit. If I remember correctly, to feature in the scene a little more, to sell the roof. So, like, behind Rosario in the background of her shot, see that move? That's the back of the movie sign. I think, if I remember correctly, they had to shift it up because I was like, what are you doing? He's like, just so, you know, to give you some depth, some background and whatnot. It was kind of cool. But I guess it's no secret that this is not the first time we ever shot up on a roof. We were shooting up on roofs from day one, boys.
That's right.
Totally.
Yeah,
with Mosier on the ladder.
Could you imagine trying to shoot a hockey game on this roof?
That'd be a boring hockey game.
There's a special effect you couldn't pay for. People really dug that, man. It was nuts how many people talk about that. Like, you know, I remember on the first Clerks, people would afterwards be like, oh, you know what I love about that movie? When Jay and Silent Bob dance outside, which I was always kind of like, fuck you, man. It's the dialogue. Never mind the fucking part where nobody's talking. You hear from a lot of cats going, you know, it was great when Rosario was dancing. So here we go to color. So suddenly all the grain's gone and whatnot, and look how yellow that joint is.
And how purple that shirt is, too. There's another example of a purple shirt. Yeah, that's pretty much the way the shirts look.
Mm-hmm. This is more representative of what real life looked like inside that joint.
Yeah.
I remember when we were shooting the flick, some people were just like, oh, it's a shame they won't see, because they'd see the dailies, because I would cut stuff together, and they'd watch scenes like, wow, they'll never see how bright it is inside movies, how colorful it is. And I was like, yeah, but who wants that? Who wants to look? Could you imagine a whole movie of that? I think you might be nauseous after a while.
I think you're right.
Not that, but the whole, you know, just all that purple and yellow and whatnot. This, you want to talk about a special effect. The love in that woman's eyes, man. Yipes.
Here's the beginning of the Super Technocrane shot.
Yeah.
Michael Rooney, choreographer.
Yes, Michael Rooney, choreographer extraordinaire. And the dude right up front, whose name escapes me, but I thank him in the credits. He was the guy, Michael Rooney was a choreographer, and he was the guy who was his main man in terms of, like, setting up all the moves and whatnot. But, man, they did a great fucking job. And how many takes did we do of that, just that crane shot alone?
A lot. I think we probably did 12 or 13.
Big ups to these dancers who were just fucking tireless.
Yeah.
And so into it, man. I guess there's very little call for a dance number anymore in movies and whatnot. So these cats were all
These are two of my favorite close-ups in the movie.
Why?
They're just great. Just the lighting and
watch the shooter and, you know, the smock, and now look at the one he's got. Like, you just see the difference in color between the two. That fucking dolly shot behind him was such a smart move that we put together. I don't even think we scripted it, but it was one of those things where we had to show off the back of his jersey. And so we kind of came up with this counter move where he's coming through the door and we're moving to pick him and crossing the line, right? And picking him up other side of Randall. And I think we did it just so we could cross the line, essentially, so we can move the access. And because we did, like, it's such a huge fucking laugh because it's the first time you really get to see that Porch Monkey for Life shirt. Every screening I was in of that movie, man, I was just like, thank God we included that shot in a big, bad way. Because it was always scripted that you would see a shirt, but, like, that was the first showcase of it rather than just cutting to it, because it's so thrown away. It's not like, hey, check this out, because we're kind of tracking Dante. So it's a kind of subtle throwaway joke and makes it a little funnier. Now, this shot, when did we decide to go Steadicam?
I think that was you.
When? Were we in pre?
No, that was like more a shot list.
Yeah, I think it was. And you just wanted to go, you know, circle them for this entire scene because of what's going on in the scene.
I remember there was a bit of a fight about it. Not a fight, but there was a bit of like, you really want to do that? Do you really want to go around?
Right.
Maybe we should do a take where it's stationary and whatnot. I get worked out rather nicely.
I do too.
And who's the Steadicam operator? You know,
Rick Davidson.
He did such a good job. He was in almost the exact place, going in each direction. That when I had to cut it together, it wasn't like so. Every once in a while, I had to kind of stay on somebody's back longer than I would have liked. But generally, I was able to go from one speaking part to the other in the counter moves, and man, it cut like butter.
He's pretty phenomenal too. And you just look at the horizon here; it's solid the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great shot.
What does that mean in terms of it's not like it's going like a boat? I keep moving my hand as if anybody can see.
Yeah, this is radio.
Right, yeah, forgot. So basically...
That's the one thing that gives a Steadicam away is if your horizon is off a little bit, if it's not level.
Right.
But that, in the entire 360, the horizon stays very, very level.
Mm-hmm. There were very few cats who online were just like, well, that was kind of pointless just going around those dudes for nothing. I liked it. I thought it really kind of heightened that scene. And it was just, you know, sometimes it's nice to do that camera move for the sake of doing the camera move. I don't think it took you out of the movie.
I don't think so either. And I think it fits with what they're talking about.
Totally.
Yeah.
But then we turn to evening rather quickly here.
Yeah, but again, nobody really seemed to notice that. I was always, whenever you're making a movie that's shot in the course of a day, look, the sun's going down kind of in the background. You can kind of tell. It's getting a little darker out there. Whenever you're doing a movie that's set over the course of one day, there's always that moment of when do we go from day to night. His headlights are on. It's. I think you're getting little tastes of it all throughout the scene.
We chose to make it from the time that they ran from the back of the place.
Yeah, it's when there was a total shift.
I always imagine that Dante stopped and had a burger.
It's the only way you really get the feel of its bright daylight out is because when we're in that 360 shot, it is awfully hot in the background.
Hot.
But I'm so concentrating or so intent on the upfront action of their conversation that I never even think about it. So then when they run through the store and suddenly it's getting dusky, I don't know, I thought it was a pretty decent changeover. And then I think in the background of one of these shots, Randall's shot, when he's talking to the Donkey Fucker, you start to see the lights in the background too at the hotel. Let's see if I used it, because we did two different shots of Jeff. I mean, same, two different takes though. And in one, there are lights on, like lights came on in the middle of him talking. And in others, the lights were off. I don't think I used the one where the lights came on.
But I think in the shot of Zach here.
Oh, there are the lights right there. 1, 2, 3, 4.
In the shot of Zach here, you're going to start to see headlights and reflected in the right there.
Right. Also, you saw his headlights like when he pulled in too.
Mm-hmm.
We had to smoke up his goggles because we were getting hardcore reflections. Because unlike now, you can get glasses where they're flat or there's no reflection or anything like that.
You can get a anti-reflection reflective coating put on most glasses.
Those goggles though were just a last minute pull and they didn't have them on there. And then this, what's coming up is this montage, which wasn't really scripted. Like the scripted part of the montage was him driving, looking for Becky, seeing the kid in the restaurant window.
I love that dolly move around the front of the car.
That was nice.
Which we did on dance floor on the process trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And all this stuff, I love the way this stuff looks. It's all, we pushed this a stop just to kind of let all the ambient light play. And I think it looks really nice.
Oh, totally. I'm
a big fan.
Yeah, it came together really nicely. Do you find yourself more of a fan of the stuff where people aren't sitting around bullshitting or talking? Because like this is really just a kind of a visual scrapbook right here, a series of shots. Like, do you find like you dig that more than when people are yammering?
Not necessarily.
No.
I mean, it's it can be sometimes more interesting. Just like you cut to the slow mo shot,
mm-hmm.
which was your idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan of it. I remember you said make this look like the original one,
where they were dancing outside.
Right, where it was just one light.
One light.
I think that's the.
I remember you were like, "Look, I'm going to give you one light, but it will be accompanied by another light." And I was like, okay, Dave, good call.
But I think, you know, that's our modern day equivalent, I think.
Yeah, very much so. But the montage, like as we were working on the movie and cutting it together and whatnot, it just felt like rather than make it all about Dante driving around looking for Becky and then seeing the kid in the restaurant, like, hold on, I'll show you an error. There's no lady behind her right now. And then when we come back to her, hey, there's a lady behind her. I kept noticing that every time I was cutting and did nothing about it. But we decided that it should be more about
everybody
than just Dante. And I think it made for, and there's that nice, it goes from a red light to a green light and then he goes forward. Subtle shit like that nobody will ever pick up on. But it turned out it's a good decision to do everybody. Kind of gives everyone their last moment before their lives change irrevocably forever. This, perhaps we oversmoked this quite a bit.
I mean,
I kept saying more smoke so it would
read.
You
know what, though? It's just like you had to have it out the back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people get it.
Yeah.
I think it's like one of those things where it's a little bit of overkill.
It wouldn't have read if it was just within the place.
Yeah.
So. It was also about,
and meanwhile,
totally,
it's that little smoke machine that's doing it all.
But it's been doing it for hours. An hour.
This is where we start getting into that light world. The light box too. Ratface was very hell bent on giving you that light box. Did it help at all? Or was it more decorative than anything else?
It was a little more decorative than anything else.
But
you know what I really like is his design for the actual Donkey Show trellis, and all the lights up there, I think, worked really, really well. All the silver park hands. And
was it is difficult to shoot smoke?
It's difficult to keep it even, but you know, Charlie was doing our smoke, and he kept it pretty even.
Charlie Ballardinelli, man, he created the fire at the beginning. He did the smoke here. Really great dude. And Gary was the dude who was in charge of the docu, right?
Gary Jensen,
our longtime stunt coordinator on this movie, was the animal wrangler.
Yeah.
And brought in Asphalt, the donkey.
Who was painless to work with.
Yeah, like they really kind of sold us on, like, this is going to be hell on earth. And she was actually...
She
took one piss, like, in the back, and that was it.
Yeah.
But she had her own little pen out behind the movies. It was pretty nice. So, how many lights you got working here?
It was quite a few KinoFlow, 4 foot four banks, and I don't know exactly how many, but we had kind of a wall to the left, kind of a wall of KinoFlows filled with these blue screen tubes, ultra blues, I believe they're called. And we tried putting them in the fixtures in the ceiling, but they took a little too much electricity, so it didn't work. And then we've got...
The red lights, like the cop lights, they just pop through naturally like that?
Mm-hmm.
That's very red?
Wow. Yeah.
How do you light that?
Very carefully. Very carefully.
Big ups to fucking Zach, man. You know, it's like that is a fearless performance right there. A dude who really went for it.
And that was Roseanne Fiedler.
Who pulled all the costumes together. But yeah, she really pulled that one together. And she was the one that suggested putting a leather mask on the donkey too. She was like, I think we should put a mask on the donkey. I was like, that's genius. I kept saying, like, I want him to have a little mask. And I think that made it all the difference for Zach's performance because he felt he was incognito. is there anything in the flick that you wish you had done differently or that you didn't achieve that you wanted to achieve? I mean, aside from things you mentioned previously, like, well, we could have done this. But, like, is there anything you wanted to achieve that you didn't achieve? Like, when you look at Clerks 2 as the DP... Do you feel like, man, like it's a fantastic showcase reel for me and what I do?
I think it is. There are just a few things I would have done differently. I think the time of day that we shot that Steadicam 360, we should have shot a little later in the day, just to match a little more. Other than that, I'm a pretty big fan.
Especially I think it's visually our most interesting. Is my favorite. Is hands down. It's my favorite of all the movies we've ever made. Hands down is visually my favorite of all the movies we've ever made. I just think, like, this is the look that I like. You know, like, I don't like glossy and slick. Right. I think there's a lot of... I think it's a well-shot movie, you know? And not even like, well, it's well-shot for that guy. I just think it's a good-looking movie. And critically, like, when you read reviews and whatnot, there were a few critics that were just, like, that did say, like, this movie looks really good. Some critics, or people that just write about flicks in general... tend to just tee off of me whenever I'm like, oh, I'm not a very strong visual stylist, and they just go, yeah, he's not a strong visual stylist, without putting much thought into it. You look at this movie, and you look at something like 40-Year-Old Virgin, what's the difference? You know, I mean, theirs is a lot slicker looking, but, like, why is that movie so, you know, shot so much better, and how come Judd Apatow is not tagged as, like, a non-visual director or something like that?
I think our movie's more natural, and I think it fits the story a little better, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've always felt that our visuals kind of really, with the exception of Dogma, which I think was a very ambitious movie for its budget, and because of it, maybe we didn't capture the right look. I mean, it's not that has nothing to do with Bobby Ohm. It's just we didn't have a lot of money to do what that movie needed to do. But generally, we kind of shoot for what the script dictates. We don't overshoot it. It's not, you know, every once in a while there's a showy flourish like the 360 shot with Steadicams when they're arguing in the back. But generally, it's very fitting for the subject matter.
I agree. I think it's very appropriate for the subject matter, and just about every scene looks the way, you know, it should. And
right there, that shot is one of my favorite shots in the movie. There's a little push in as they come to the camera. It's all this tiny motion.
Handheld push in, too. It's again, it's Andy Graham riding the dolly. The dog show's all handheld.
Mm-hmm.
We need a lot of handheld in the movie. Probably close to half.
Yeah, at least half. I mean, the whole jail scene is handheld. This sequence is handheld.
I think this movie has, like, it seems, it all comes together, though. Like, I feel like beyond all the movies we've made before, there isn't that sequence where you're just like, oh, we didn't quite have enough money there, or we didn't spend enough time here, or, like, there's a connective tissue where it's like you always feel like you're watching the exact same movie. You always feel that, like, everything is connected. You're never taken out by a moment of, like, you know, there wasn't enough money, or you know, we cut out a whole big section or anything like that. It's just like, you know, this one more than any of them just sort of, like, all flows together, like, all the pieces of it. And there's also just, like, but I also think there's, like, it's not moving because it's just to create movement. It's just that idea of, like, you know, there's just, it's built into it.
Right.
And everything's sort of happening. It feels like it's not forcing anything, you know. It's just sort of, it's going around. But you always feel like you're watching the exact same movie.
I would agree with that.
And, like, you know, Jersey Girl, Jay and Bob, like, there's just moments where it's like, it just gets a little bit outside of, it doesn't quite all come together. I mean, generally they do, but this one always feels like everything belongs to the whole and sort of, like, all works together.
I think this, Chasing Amy and Clerks, probably the movies that we've made that the visuals best suit the material. It's perfect marriage between material and visual. I mean, even something like Mallrats, you look at it, and it's like, I mean, that was, I look at that movie, to me, that movie feels more amateurish than Clerks, because at least with Clerks, the grain and shit kind of hit it, but, like, you look at Mallrats, and it's like, clearly, we're not quite sure what we're doing yet, and we'll get better as we go along, but, like, you look at the movie, and it has all the hallmarks or earmarks of a movie shot by people that are like, is this how you do it? And because I think that's a movie where the budget makes it even more apparent. Like, the lack of budget on Clerks hides, you know, the kind of amateurishness. But on Mallrats, it's like the budget's a big magnifying glass where it's like, oof.
And nothing really felt intentional. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, even with Clerks, even though it was born out of necessity, it felt intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
Mallrats really sort of, there's a few moments in Mallrats where I think we hit our stride, and there's, like, a few scenes where I'm like, oh, the whole movie could have been that. Like when they go to the dirt mall, you know, it's like, there's a few moments in that movie. Yeah. Where it's like, you feel like, oh, the whole movie could have been this. But then there's, like, you know, the action sequence where you get your foot on the truck. It's just like, it pulls you out a little bit. 'Cause you're like, I mean,
Example of us going, like, how do we, let's shoot an insert of the foot hitting the trailer, like, and just really figuring it out as we went along. But yeah, it's, I mean, it's not like the movie doesn't work, but, like, you look at it and it's just like, yeah, it's kind of growing pains right there.
Yeah. Like, I don't think there's anything in this movie ever that sort of, like, even the examples that Dave cites aren't moments that make you go, like,
ooh, they fucked up.
That make you aware that, like, it never takes you out of the story. Like, that, you know, even with the fact that, like, those two things transition like that, it's just like, I mean, that's something where it's like, nobody's really, I think people are pretty glued into the story at this point.
Were you able to, in that 360 shot, were you able to kind of dial down that background?
Not as much as I'd like. I think that's one of the problems I had with our version of the DI, is I don't think it really held the highlights as much as it could have. It was a little too blown out for me. What we did there is we covered them up with a 40x80 foot black silk, and that made it consistent no matter what time we were shooting it. But I think I just let the background of that shot blow out a little bit too much.
You fucked up, Dave.
Totally.
This jail proved to be a sound challenge for Whit Norris, our sound guy. Whit, who's worked with us on, he was on, what was the first movie?
Jay and Silent
Was it Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back?
Or was it Dogma? That was Dogma, wasn't it?
Dogma, right? Dogma was Wit. Then Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Then he was off working with Chris Rock while we were doing Jersey Girl.
And then he came back.
And then he came back for this. Who's fantastic. He's my fave. This dude really knows what he's doing. He's an expert at it. Who he had Cat working with him, and the Boom guy's name was
Doug.
Was fucking genius on this movie. I mean, it's, you know, it's weird when you give a shout out to the Boom guy, cause people are like, what the fuck, he held a pole. You know what? It's very difficult to hold a pole in a movie like this where everybody's fucking talking.
There's a lot of people. I mean, like, you know, like the Boom guys, like Andy Graham, who's the operator. It's just like, you know, the operator and the Boom guy have a relationship.
That's right.
You know, that people don't think about, but like the operator is the guy who's got to eye the Boom, and the Boom guy's the guy who's got to try to not make it so he's worried.
I've watched every frame of footage on this flick. I've never once did the Boom ever come in. There was one time where we thought it was that push in when Jeff and Trevor are at the internet kiosk, and we push in on him, and Jeff's going shh, covering his mouth. There was one where, like, on the day when we were shooting, we had to go one more take because Andy thought the Boom might have dipped in, because the move kind of caught Doug off guard, I guess, a little bit. But even when when I looked at it in the editing room, you couldn't even see it. It wasn't even there. Those dudes were aces, man.
Yeah, Andy was a big fan of Doug's. So,
yeah,
I mean, they had a great working relationship.
Every once in a while, you're working on a flick, and it's not just because you cite somebody or highlight somebody, it doesn't mean everyone else sucks. But, like, every once in a while, you meet those people that become absolutely indispensable, where it's just like, you got to bring those cats back again and again.
And you also, there's moments where it's like, when you start out in the industry and you're just like a Boom guy, or there's all kinds
of... You were the Boom
of,
guy on Clerks.
I was the Boom guy on Clerks.
Andy, which to your credit. to your credit, the Boom never really came in on that movie either.
But there's
I don't remember all the footage, but...
Every time you work on a movie, I've found that, like, as we go along, it's the people that are indispensable, but they're also, like, there's the moment where you're like, you realize what a great Boom operator is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you realize what a great AC is, which is the first thing you learn pretty easily, because when they fuck up, it's pretty easy to tell. But, like, all those things, like, there's all these departments, location managers, like, all these
people. Location manager on this movie was phenomenal.
James. I'm going to say Gearman.
Let's just say James, and then we'll
G-I-E-R-M-A-N.
Well, James, you know, finding the closed-down fast food joint in the United States of America is fucking virtually impossible. It's why this country is so fat, because these places don't close. And anytime one's about to close, somebody else comes in. That we had this one burger joint that we were looking at, and before we could even make our offer, fucking Wendy's swooped in. We're like, fuck you, we're going to biggie size it. So it was tough to find a closed-down one, particularly not just any closed-down fast food joint, but one that existed in an area in California that didn't look like California.
Yeah.
And James, and he works with that woman whose name escapes me at the moment.
Cat.
Well, no, Cat's on the sound crew.
It's a different Cat.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Two Cats?
Yeah. Wow.
Those guys did a great job at finding this, not just this place, but every place that we use in the movie, even the Skid Marks joint, which, you know, some people saw the movie and said, I knew that wasn't in Jersey because there's no way there's a, you know, what go-kart joint is near a freeway in Jersey? I'm like, yeah, you're fucking mine. I get you by process of elimination, there must be a go-kart joint near a freeway in Jersey, near a parkway, as we call it there.
But as you go through, you know, like it is those moments where you get to see, like, somebody fill a position or fill a role on a movie. And because being on Mallrats, we all get onto Mallrats because on Clerks, there was only three of us. But you get to Mallrats and you see all these people and you're kind of like just figuring out what the fuck everybody does. And then you go through the process of realizing, like, that's what they do. And there's the person who does it, like, exceedingly well. Here's the person who really can make a difference or an impact on the movie. Like, you know, the Boom guy can make an impact on the movie. You know, our sound guys make an impact on the movie in that we don't have to ADR anything. We didn't ADR anything. We didn't have to replace any dialogue because it was
an
audible.
The car stuff, which apparently is the trickiest stuff to record when you're shooting the pictures, anything that's in a car, because, you know, you've got the noise of not just a car, but like a process trailer that's carrying the car, the camera truck in front of the car, the traffic behind the car. And Whit did a phenomenal job. The dudes at Skywalker, Gary and Tom, who are our mixers, great dudes, and always do a great job for us, they were like, this is amazing. He recorded such great sound in a process trailer. I've never heard it before. They were kind of very impressed. So, yeah, it's as you go along, you find, like, really talented people that just pop, and you only learn about how talented they are based on working with people that maybe aren't as good as them or something like that.
I mean, for, like, you, it's like if you meet an operator, it's like there's a couple kinds. There's, like, the kind, at any given moment in a movie, they're the people who bring something, and then the people who are, like, will do what you tell them to. Which is fine, which is great.
But they don't offer anything.
Yeah, it's like there are people who are very efficient.
People that just kind of execute and don't elevate.
Yeah, right. and like those people are great. But the moment that you find that person where you're just like, they have suggestions, they have ideas, and they're participating, and they're making the movie better, those are the people that you want back, and those are the people you want to work
with. And then I'll go you one better. Aside from the people who don't just execute but elevate, so they're bringing something to and are great at their job, these people are also, like, great personalities.
Yeah.
Because when you're sitting around, like, you know, there's a lot of fucking harsh language being thrown back and forth. And you know, you're working under your $5 million budget. It's comfy, but it's not as comfy as maybe some cats you used to work with or for. And sometimes you ask them to go over longer hours. Great personalities. Like, really warm people, giving people. You know, it would suck if you had somebody in the mix that was just a real, like, stick in the mud and shit. That person would kind of bring it down for everybody else. Like one of our DPs on the other movie. But, you know, this is, this crew, like the crew that we had on Clerks 2 was pretty much an amalgam of almost every crew we'd ever worked with on any flick, from Clerks all the way forward to Jersey Girl. Like, there were people that have worked on each one, and in this one, there were a few new people that were in the mix as well. Like, you know, Derek, who was Transpo, we worked with.
Jay and Silent Bob,
and to some degree on Jersey Girl as well when we did some of the LA portion stuff. Whit we'd worked with before in the sound department. Dave, of course, Andy Graham we've worked with before.
Carol Banker,
script supervisor, phenomenal script supervisor, my right hand. We've worked with her before. Laura Greenlee is the line producer.
Yeah.
Roseanne Feeler had worked on Mallrats.
Yeah, not as the costume designer, but
in the costume department. I mean, the list goes on and on. And then every once in a while, you got new people in the mix, like Doug or Kat or James Graham. Or Jeremy Graham, who was fantastic. Jeremy Graham, what is Jeremy Graham's job exactly? Explain what he does.
He's the gaffer, basically. And he's, like you said, Carol's your right hand. He's my right hand.
Right.
In the lighting, you know, lighting department. He's the head of the electric department. So he and I basically liked the movie together.
Mm-hmm. I remember he came up in the editing room one day and spent a long time watching everything and was just so fucking delighted in a way that, like, you rarely see, you know, a gripper electric get that enthused about the movie. They're generally just like, when do we eat and when are we done? But, like, he was really kind of dialed in on the story, but also just really dialed in on the look, was so happy with the look of it. Like,
He really cares about what he does.
Yeah, totally. It shows. And motherfucker can eat a bear claw.
Yes, he won $1,000.
Won $1,000 in one of the worst bets ever made with DK, who was Jeff Stanton, made a bet that he couldn't eat this giant bear claw and, like, gave him 10 minutes, didn't he?
He gave him 20 minutes and he ate it in 8 or so.
Yeah, it was fucking nuts. It was a giant bear claw, too, to be fair. Good. It was like a sheet cake. But yeah, aside from being able to light a good looking picture, man could put it away. And he's a thin dude, too.
Yeah.
It was a real Cool Hand Luke kind of moment.
It was.
He never once puked, as far as I know. This was something that we kind of grabbed right next door. The building next door to us, on one side of us, was the Days Inn Motel where we all stayed. On the other side was this Union Hall.
It's the Grocers Union?
Or something.
Grocer bag?
I don't know, but it doubled as our bank. It also doubled as the abortion clinic.
Yeah.
And it was in the background of almost every shot, too.
And they actually owned the property to the...
Where the movies was. Yeah. So big ups to them. They let us shoot there and never complained about eat pussy on the back of the, on the side of the building. That was literally the back of Quick Stop where those dudes were coming out. And you want to talk about being able to pull the wool over an audience's eyes. You'd never once see the inside of a burned down Quick Stop, you know, aside from that one CG shot in the beginning like with three simple shots of like dudes sawing a tiny piece of wood on the roof, the dudes throwing out material out the back door,
changing a light bulb,
and painting in a corner. People go like, wow, they rebuilt it. You know, it was, I guess maybe nobody gives a shit. Nobody was sitting there going, I demand to see the burnt out husk to prove that it was burned down.
I heard somebody asking for their money back.
Who?
Somebody was so mad.
Yeah, they were fucking like, outraged.
That reconstruction's bullshit. I think it was clean the building up.
It was Trevor Furman. It what, in CG?
Yeah. On the other side of the sign, we cleaned up some of the dirt.
Yeah, but we don't clean up the fucking shot. Right here, where Jay and Silent Bob are walking in, it says "Dot" next to the RST video door. Some local graffiti artist.
You can't cover hate.
No, you can't. There's no CG for hate. This was the last Jay and Silent Bob shot, wasn't it?
This was the last shot. Was this the last day? I think this was the morning of the last day, wasn't it?
I don't remember exactly, but.
This is the morning of the last day, because we shot this, and then we shot Dante's coverage, and then we went and saw it.
And I remember right before we went, I kind of threw that Justice onto his jersey, onto his hoodie, just for sake of doing it with some electric tape, gaffer tape. What kind of tape is that? Technical commentary. What kind of tape
gaffer's
is that?
Tape. Gaffer's tape, which is a cloth tape.
This, once again, we could not shoot while the place was open, so... That's shot at night, correct?
Yes.
And it's the steel shutters are open, but we're covered by our reopen banner.
We discussed it, and we're like, we don't want the shutters down because that's like the first movie, but we want to have light coming in, right. But we have to shoot at night.
Yeah.
So we basically put the sign, the big sign up.
Some signs back there, and then we just
blow out the windows.
Yeah, we blast them with some HMIs and.
But this was shot at night.
It was, and it was. We were pretty lucky with this. We used a pretty wide lens, but also that the floor. We were lucky that the floor was smooth enough.
It's true because we were talking about laying track down so we can get a smooth shot. And me and Dave went back and forth with it, where Dave was like, "I think the floor is pretty solid. I think we're good without the track." And I'm like, "I don't know, dude. I don't want to take a risk."
Well,
because this works.
Well, we had a little. Chapman makes this little. It's not a gyro head, but they call it their stabilizer or something, and it's got some springs in it, so it just smooths out any bump that
any
you might
bumps,
feel.
But there were no bumps there.
It was pretty good.
Because remember, we were talking about, like, let's get a quote from Grossberg about pulling back and you're seeing dolly track, if we have to digitally erase the dolly. But we did it without the track, and it all worked out.
And then it was a CG shot.
And there are people that hate this movie, very few, but who still like that last shot. Some people maintain if the whole movie had been that last shot, it'd be genius.
And that was the last shot that we did.
And that was the last shot that was shot on the whole production. And we shot a color, and then he just kind of dialed all the color out.
Well, Joe actually took it out, and as he takes it out, he adds that black and white grain to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it matches black and white stock very well.
I do love that shot. I dream about that shot for years and years and years, and man, it couldn't have come off better than that. And when I dream about it, I never even dream... Have my mother in the foreground at the very, very end. So that was just kind of good timing that she was in Jersey at the same time. Because, boy, it takes you right back to the fucking first one.
Yeah, it does.
So here's a bunch of, we didn't even give shout-outs to the makeup and the hair people.
And
also
hair
technical.
And
props. Lisa D'Alva, who was awesome.
And all the production staff
let's just say there were no dickheads on the movie, so all these people are absolutely tremendous. Some of them I don't know personally.
Everybody was pretty awesome, and if I see somebody I don't like, I will point them out.
Totally.
Everybody was...
There's that Mike Ciccone. He's a problem.
Yeah.
No, Smalls. He's a good guy.
Around.
Yeah, that's why he's been working for us for years. Everybody did a really, really great job on the flick. As I said, to Dave when we were done shooting, on the night we wrapped after we shot that pullback shot and whatnot. I told you then, I repeat it now, I will never make another movie without you. Even if you're busy, I would wait for you. I would sit around and wait for you. Because I couldn't have been happier with this flick. Even if you turn the volume down, I couldn't be happier with the look of this flick. It tells a story. And boy, he learned a lot. But that was never, it's not like, boy, he learned a lot, so he's fucking good to come back with us. Because I was good at what I did, and I had to work with better people or something like that.
I think it's good that I went away, though.
In what way?
Just that I did a lot of work while I was away,
right.
and I was I ready for Dogma and the other movies? Probably not.
But neither were we.
Well,
I mean, we all I think this movie is an example of like all of us sort of like, you know, there's a lot of like intelligence and like thought put into what we did compared to like the movies when we were together or the movies when we were apart, you know, all of it, you know, it was.
Do you think that comes with maturity or you think that's just one of those things that would have eventually happened, or
I think it's a mixture of like one. I also think that the three of us, under the conditions of making this movie, I don't think we felt overwhelmed on any level.
Yeah,
I
mean, it was actually kind
of like we were able to arrive to it and be like, let's talk about this and talk about that, and you don't feel like you're being scrutinized. Or
do you think the lower budget has a lot to do with that?
I think it helps on that level once again, where it's like people are more inclined to allow us to go do whatever we want. Nobody asked to see how we were going to make it look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the studio, to their credit, never asked us to be like, well, let's see how you plan on desaturating.
Yeah, we weren't asked for makeup tests or any screen tests.
We were able
sort
to kind of create the look we want. We were able to shoot it the way we want.
And we started with one production exec who was John Gordon. Then he left Miramax and went to Universal.
Yeah.
And then we were with Carla Gardini for the rest of the time. And she was great. She hung out quite a bit.
She was always
really supportive and loved whatever we were doing and was never like, you know, you're fucking it up. So, but you're right. Nobody ever said, like, you got to show us what you're doing.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, and that creates an atmosphere where you feel more, you know, and so we all feel more able to do things and relate to each other and throw things out there. And then it travels downward where the crew feels more able to contribute and throw out their ideas, and you create that atmosphere and, like, that's the feeling I had from the very beginning, is that, you know, we all were sort of, we were all on the same level, you know?
Were we shooting the movie a year ago, or did we start at the end of September, beginning of October?
I think it was the end of September.
So yeah, we were in pre right now last year.
Yeah.
That's fast. That's the way I like to do it now. I like that expedient schedule.
Literally, the movie is going to come out on DVD when we wrapped.
Yeah.
Production.
That's awesome. That's the way to do it, man.
That's very fucking fast.
It's not like fucking Dogma and Jersey Girl where we were sitting around for fucking months going like,
year.
When's this movie coming out? Totally. But
like,
it's 13 years after we did the first one. Do you guys feel old?
I don't feel old. I feel mature.
I'm still so young for what I do.
You are? How old are you?
33.
Yeah, you were always younger than us. I'm 36 and you're 35. Yeah. You turned 36 when? March. And when do you turn?
I turned 34 in December.
So you still feel kind of young.
Yeah.
No dick problems yet?
Not yet.
That'll come. thanks for hanging out. Listen to the commentary track. This is Kevin Smith signing off.
Scott Mosier.
Dave Klein.
Thanks for watching.